Welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. I am your host, Chris Panaski. This podcast was created so as to share the stories of bike tours, bike packers, and endurance racers from around the world as they embark on amazing adventures. Through their stories, you'll be able to learn the ins and outs of bike travel. You'll get insight into various countries and cultures, hear fantastic stories of their journeys, and through both mine and my guests' experiences, you'll learn about the pros and cons of specific gear, bikes, and bike setups. If you're new to bike travel and considering going on an adventure, I hope the podcast provides you with that extra little bit of motivation to make it happen. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is proudly supported by Panorama Cycles, Redshift Sports, Tailfin Bikepacking Equipment, Race Day Fuel, and Full Cycle Ottawa. Their continued support allows me to focus my efforts on providing you amazing content. Now back to the show. Hey, welcome back to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Panaski, and today we're diving into a story that redefines what it means to push limits. My guest is Hannah Otto, a professional mountain biker, Olympic long team member, and the mastermind behind the Moab Triple Crown, a trilogy of iconic mountain bike routes across some of Utah's most famous trails. In this episode, we unpack her recent Moab Triple Crown FKT, diving into each of the events, tasting disappointment, and smashing records. But this isn't just about speed. It's about grit, solitude, and the kind of growth that only comes through suffering. We'll explore Hannah's upbringing, her evolution as an athlete, the mindset behind her self-imposed challenges, and what it means to chase something that no one else has done before. So whether you're tuning in from the saddle or the sofa, get ready for a ride through resilience, strategy, and the raw beauty of pushing past your edge. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is supported by some pretty rad companies. A couple of them are Panorama Cycles and Full Cycle Ottawa. The new Panorama Katadin 2.1 is a gravel rig tuned for long-haul comfort and wild terrain. Built with lighter tubing and progressive geometry, the frame has also been tested to full mountain bike standards for durability and peace of mind, even when the trail disappears and the terrain gets rowdy. With integrated mounts, generous tire clearance, and reliability-first components, it's the bike packer's dream machine. Roll deeper, explore wilder, ride the Katadin 2.1. On gravel roads or cruising through city streets, Full Cycle Ottawa has been your trusted ride companion for over 30 years. Locally rooted and rider-approved, they stock top-tier bikes from legendary brands like Norco, Cannondale, Cervelo, and distribute Panorama Cycles. From expert service to cutting-edge gear, Full Cycle keeps your wheels turning. Ready to roll? Swing by today. Your next adventure starts at Full Cycle Ottawa. Hannah, welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. It's very cool to have you here.
Thanks so much. I'm super excited to chat today.
And I really got to know, who was it that emailed me in the first place? You have like a marketing manager type thing, or is it somebody that's involved with the documentary itself? Was that? I'm guessing that.
Yeah, it's the media team for Competitive Cyclists. Oh, so okay. Since they were owning the project, they helped reach out to noteworthy sources so that we could get this story out to the public.
Yeah, that's very cool. I was like, oh, look at this. A mountain bike racer who's got her own PR firm.
I can dream.
Yeah, we could all get there one day. just rolling into this, I guess. You know, welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. And before diving into the Moab Triple Crown, can you tell us, listeners, a bit more about yourself and what drives you as an athlete?
Such hard questions.
You can skip the whole second part if you just want to tell us about yourself first.
Yeah, so I've been racing endurance sport for 20 years now, which is crazy to say because I'm 29 years old. So yes, I started in endurance sport when I was 9 in triathlon. I raced triathlon for 11 years before focusing exclusively on the mountain bike. And since then, I've had just a whirlwind of a career from 5 collegiate cycling national titles to an elite marathon mountain bike national title to being on the Olympic long team. I've represented the U.S. at 6 world championships. I've won the Leadville 100. Nice. I've gotten to do, it feels like, I mean, I want to say a little bit of everything, but then I think of the goals I still have ahead of me. I'm like, no, not even close to everything.
You're scratching the surface.
Exactly. I'm just scratching the surface, but I've gotten to do a lot of things that the young me dreamed of. And some of those things being these FKTs. And I think going into that second part of the question, part of what drives me in this sport is the adventure and to see what is possible. And so I find both of those things in racing and the FKTs. On one hand, the racing, I find the opportunity to challenge myself against some of the best in the world, to constantly seek that improvement is what makes me keep lining up. And in the FKTs, I feel that as well. I feel this sense of adventure of being out there all alone, and it's just on me. What can I do? And I'm lucky enough that that means I get to attempt many of times to be the fastest woman ever on these routes.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, it's about being the fastest I can be. And so that's the whole impetus for this Moab Triple Crown, is to encourage others. Maybe you can beat my time. If you can, fabulous, that's go amazing. Do it. But if not, still go and get your fastest known time, because yeah. I think what we will share the same experience. It doesn't matter how fast or how slow you go. You and I feel like in this space of mountain biking, we can all feel those same incredible feelings of accomplishment and overcoming.
Yeah, I think it's, obviously, like, driven, like you said, driven to succeed or whatever. Because, like, to start at 9 years old, I know, like, for most people, there's a big gap from the age of where you can drive a car till kind of the late 20s, where people just want to drink and party. And to be a professional athlete of any level, like, there's got to be something different that drives you to not follow that, you know, downward spiral, I guess. And that's kind of what separates the cream from the milk, or however you say it, when it comes to professional athletes. I guess a lot of people kind of just fall out of it because they want that normal life, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, I think for me, like I said, I've gotten to experience so many things that I think I'm lucky in, that from a very young age, I saw that. I saw the experiences I was getting to have, and I dreamed of the experiences I might have one day. And for me, I feel like for 20 years, I've been chasing. I've been chasing the next adventure. And like, I can't imagine it any other way, because I always have something on the horizon that I want to do next.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I'm going to ask as well about parents, because, they had to be so deeply involved to help you get to this point, because, you know, I work with some teachers whose kids play high-level hockey, and, like, it's insane how much commitment it is on the parents' part. Judging by how accomplished you are across the various disciplines, what kind of advice could you give to parents like us on how maybe your parents took you in that right direction?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of a funny one, because sometimes when I say I start when I was nine, I'll almost get like this weird backlash of like, well, that wasn't your choice, that was your parents' choice.
That's bad parenting.
This was very much my choice. My parents never raced endurance sports. They'd never done triathlon. They were not cyclists. This was fully me. And, you know, so I played soccer, and I would always ask my mom to get me to the field early to run laps around the field. And eventually she says, hold on, I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me.
No. Bless you.
Okay.
I'll try to delete that.
I'll start that over. So I would always ask my mom to get me to practice early to run laps around the field. And eventually she says, do you just want to run? Do you want to do a running race? And I said, yeah, that sounds really fun. And so she signs me up for this little kid's 1 mile fun run. And we show up to the fun run, and there's a booth at the expo advertising a triathlon. And at 9 years old, I saw that booth and I pointed to it and I said, that is what I want to do.
Oh.
And my mom said, they don't have that for kids. Maybe when you're older. And the guy standing at the booth said, oh, no. Yes, they do. And so my mom found me a kids triathlon camp. I learned how to race triathlon, and the rest was history. And from there, you're absolutely right. It takes a village to raise an athlete. And from 9 years old until I was old enough to sign my own race waiver at 18, that's a lot of races. So from the time I was 9 until the time I went to college, my mom came with me to over 150 races.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely incredible. So while it was entirely my own desire and my own drive, I absolutely had the support necessary to get me there. And I'm very lucky for that. And so my encouragement to parents would be to help facilitate the desire. Mm. You know, I think for me, my parents never pushed me. My mom would never make me go to a race or make me go to practice. But when I would ask to do it, she would make it possible. And so while I'm not old enough at that time to be researching races and finding them, she might tell me, hey, there's a race a month from now. Would you like to do it? And then I would have to bring it up again before she would register me. And so that was a way that she was able to constantly check in that this was something on my mind that I wanted to do.
Okay, that's very, very cool. And I have a buddy in Texas, and you know, his daughters both swim competitively, and they do all these like kids triathlons. And yeah, there's a lot of social media posts. And if they only post one picture for every event, it's like there's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
How did your experiences in USA World Championship teams influence this approach to FKTs?
I've been on the USA Cycling World Championship team for both cross-country Olympic and cross-country marathon. So 90-minute races and, well, this last World Championship was over 7 hours. So I've done the two different disciplines with USA Cycling. And I think, you know, for me, it is very different, especially the cross-country Olympic. That's a circuit race. You're racing typically 5-6 laps, and it's an hour and a half full gas. The cross-country marathon is a little bit different. It's usually one big loop, or this year it's a point-to-point, but that's much longer. So that's more similar to the FKTs that I do. But to me, the biggest difference actually is I feel like in those races, you are seeking perfection.
Right.
Because you do have essentially every possible tool at your disposal. You know, whether it's before the race even starts with, you know, your soigneur and your mechanic and the whole staff of USA Cycling, to during the race where you have multiple feed zones. You have places where if you have a mechanical, you can stop. During these FKTs, what I've discovered is, and learned, I should say what I've learned, because I didn't begin with this approach. I came in with that approach of, okay, I'm going to nail this. I'm going to achieve perfection.
Yeah.
But what I learned very quickly is perfection isn't possible in these types of efforts. What you're seeking is an ability to withstand whatever comes your way. And I think actually what these FKTs, it's less of what I've taken into these FKTs and more of what they have given me, because I came in with that attitude and I've come out with what I think is this robustness that I now can bring back into those races where I do seek perfection, but now I don't hold so tightly to it, because I've learned through these FKTs that even if it's not perfect, it can still be really good.
Yeah. You've learned to like adapt and overcome some things that previously you had a team that would just do all the adapting for you.
Exactly.
So let's dive into the Triple Crown. What was the vision behind it? Because I know you kind of, you took two existing events or routes, and then you, I believe, created the White Rim route, or was that already existing?
The White Rim was already existing. I created the whole enchilada route.
Oh, it was the whole enchilada you created. Okay. And then you took the three and you said, let's make this into like one epic challenge. And
exactly.
So what inspired this? Like, what was the idea?
Yeah. So to me, these three routes, what I wanted to do was create, so from the very beginning, when I did this first FKT of the whole enchilada in Moab, it started with that one because the whole enchilada is my absolute favorite trail.
Okay.
To me, it's just, it's spectacular. It starts with high alpine riding, goes through the desert, comes out on the rocky ledges, and ends at the Colorado Trail. It's gorgeous. It has all different kinds of landscape. And by adding the climb in, it's also tremendously challenging.
So the climb makes it into a loop, right?
The climb makes it into a loop. Gotcha. Exactly. So, you know, the whole enchilada, all of these trails are very well established. What I did was just establish it as this is the record course.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes. And then when I started to consider pursuing that one, it really inspired this thought of, well, what is so great about mountain biking? Since this is my favorite route, what do I love about it? What do I love about mountain biking in general? And what routes encapsulate that? And so I put together what I thought were three routes that encapsulate the best of mountain biking. Mm. That together, if you do these three routes, you will see everything, in my opinion, that mountain biking has to offer. Spectacular views, remote landscapes, challenging terrain, technical abilities, speed. To me, the list goes on and on. But the idea is anyone who goes and does all three of these routes can walk away feeling like a well-rounded, well-experienced mountain bike rider.
Okay, gotcha. I love mountain biking. So I like bikepacking, but if that route has mountain bike trails in it, that's my jam.
Absolutely.
So let me see. I was just checking where I was. So each one is they have their own distinct features that makes them special in their own kind of way, right?
Absolutely.
I believe the whole enchilada comes in at around 55 miles. So it's just a little
bit,
90 kilometers Canadian, 8,000 feet of elevation. So making it into a full loop, it starts with the climb, I presume?
It starts with the climb,
yeah.
Yep, and you climb, I believe it was 3.5 hours to begin the effort. So it's a long climb, almost 8,000 feet of climbing out of the gate.
But the rest of it's coasting, right? No.
Well, in some, you know, it's not coasting, but then you do basically turn around, you know, it's not an out and back, but you hit the top, turn around, and you are coming straight back down.
Fun.
But it is so technical that it really is a full body experience.
Yeah, I was watching the video, and it's like there's definitely a bit more abuse on that route, right?
Yes, very chunky,
rocky. Yeah,
very challenging, very hard on your body and on your equipment. When I first began that one of my biggest concerns was just being able to manage my equipment across that terrain. If you go out on any given weekend throughout the whole year when that trail is open, you will watch people walking their bikes down the trail looking for the outlets because they have broken either themselves or their bikes on some sort of feature on that trail. So that's one that I immediately learned how to manage my equipment, manage my energy in order to not just be fast, but be smooth, which is ultimately what then would be required on the Cocopelli, which was even longer effort, much longer effort. And I really had to make sure that I was managing my body, my equipment, because as an unsupported effort, that's a long ways to make sure that you can get it from point to point.
So is the whole enchilada would probably be the most technical of the routes in terms of mountain biking skill-wise?
Definitely.
What kind of bike did you use? And did you use the same bike for all three routes, or did you kind of switch it up to adjust for types of riding?
So I, as a professional athlete, I have different Seven. Contracts. Okay. And so for my first two, I was riding for Pivot. Okay. And so for the whole enchilada and the Cogopelli, I was on the Pivot Mach 4 SL. Okay. And then this last year for the White Rim, I now ride for Scott. And so I was on the Scott Spark.
Okay. Yeah. Sweet. And yeah, it's just insane that it's like 8,000 feet of elevation before really starting to descend. What's the most brutal part of the climb? I mean, I guess it's just long, but are there some really tough sections or is it all kind of just relatively going?
The hardest part definitely comes at the top. You climb up, first it begins on the road and then you hit sort of a gravel road, then it becomes more of a forest road, and then the last few miles are on single track, and the pitch just gets steeper and steeper and steeper. And particularly when I did it as well, as you're going up in elevation, it also gets colder and damper. And so when I was finally reaching the top, the trail was very wet, very muddy. And so you also have to navigate some of those changes in weather and terrain as you go up higher. Right.
And
elevation gain. I was just going to say, and elevation gain. So as you're getting tired, you're also getting less oxygen. And that's something that we had to account for. My coach and I had to account for when we were developing our pacing plan as well.
That's what I was going to ask it. Because I know that you're at 11,000 feet. So that's probably up like 3,500 meters, maybe a little bit less. I'm not sure. 3,500 probably. Yeah, so it must affect your breathing and pacing and just your ability to keep pushing, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, so the higher you go up, the more your power numbers, if you use a power meter, is going to be impacted.
Right.
So from 4,000 feet where you're starting to 11,000 feet at the top, you're talking about, just on paper, if you look at any sort of power chart, you're talking about an 18 to 20% decrease in power.
Oh, wow.
And so even if you're maintaining the same effort level or in theory the same pace, you'll still watch your numbers slide throughout the whole climb. And so that then opens the conversation of, well, do you start a little bit harder to account for that? Or do you just mentally prepare that, okay, I know it's going to decrease the whole time and don't panic. It doesn't mean you're going slower. Or do you start slower and try and push into it at the top? There's a lot of different ways that you can go about it. But
so what was your theory?
I did a little bit of the first two. I did start a little bit on the higher side, knowing that I would lose some at the top. But then I was also aware, okay, I am going to lose some. So I'm not going to try to maintain the power the whole time.
So
I'm just going to
tone it down just a bit. Yeah,
exactly. I'm going to start high and tone it down throughout, being okay with that. Also understanding that I still have this whole descent ahead. So I don't want to reach the top fully on my limit, because that's how you make mistakes on technical terrain.
Yeah. And did you have as a professional athlete too, you have resources like people that, you know, look at your numbers regularly and through race season. So they also have an idea of how to help you judge, okay, this is what power you should ride for the first section. Then we should tone it down to here. So if you don't that, it's like just getting used to numbers and trying to figure it out as best you can. And, you know, if you don't achieve your goal, you just go for it again some other time.
Try it again. Exactly. Yeah. Which is exactly what I had to do with the Cogopelli.
Yeah. And so you beat the previous record by nearly an hour, right? 5 hours, 50 minutes, 38 seconds, if I'm correct. I think I am.
Yep, exactly.
Was there a moment, you know, when you realized you were doing something pretty sweet and historic?
That one was interesting because, yes and no. Like I said, I was so nervous about having some sort of mechanical issue or crashing. And some of the most technical pieces, if you know the whole enchilada, come towards the end.
Okay.
And so it kind of felt like I was sort of holding my breath the whole time, because one mistake can cost you the whole thing. And so there, you know, with about when I got closer to the end, I looked at my time, I looked at the distance I had to go, I knew the pace I had to hold, and then I actually changed the screen on my computer because I just wanted to lock in to the feeling, to the terrain. And so it wasn't until I crossed the finish line and saw the time that I could finally exhale and celebrate that success. Because, yeah, it's in all of these FKTs, I've learned that you can never let your guard down because that's when a mistake happens.
And I guess as a racer too, you know, you've probably learned that the hard way at some point in your career, that just when you think things are locked in, you know, you could be on the last roller and you wipe out and people pass you and you're like, so.
Exactly.
Yeah, it must be nerve-wracking too in that sense that things have been going so well, so in your mind, you're like, something's going to go wrong.
Yeah, well, and it's the other thing that's interesting with these FKTs as opposed to races is in races, when you are racing against competition, you can see how they're doing and you, whether cognitively or not, or consciously or subconsciously, you take data from that. So, oh, well, I dropped them on the climb, so I'm better at them than climbing, or I dropped them halfway through, so they're getting tired. But in this case, you're racing against a time. You're racing against someone that's done this before, and you may or may not know them. You may or may not know how their day went. They might have had a tailwind at the end. And so you're racing this time that you don't know was the last leg their strongest, and you're going to slow down and they're going to speed up. And so it can become a really interesting game mentally as well to think about, well, I'm ahead now, but what if this was their weakest moment and it's my strongest? You don't have the same data that you have in racing when you can look at someone's face and say, oh, okay, they're in more pain than me.
Yeah. The only thing you can think about on FKT is like, I'm pretty sure by now everybody has suffered.
Exactly.
Yeah. The Cocopelli Trail, 137 miles long, 16,000 feet of elevation gain. And I guess I could throw it out there that you did finally get your goal of 11:53:30. It goes from Moab to, is that Loma, Colorado? Is that?
Yep, Loma, Colorado. It's Loma. People might be more familiar with Grand Junction, Colorado.
Oh, okay.
Right next door. Yeah.
And what makes this route so unique and challenging that you wanted to include it in the Triple Crown?
This is a really well sought after route. A lot of people do this for not only FKTs, but also people bikepacking. Most people who do this route do it in 3 to 5 days. They do it with a support vehicle that meets them in the evening, you know, sets up camp for them. It's a really, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's definitely probably the more enjoyable way to do it. This is a really special trail because it's extremely remote. And so these are places to me that most people will only ever get to see on two wheels. And for me, that's something really special. And for me, this was also the longest ride I had ever done at this point, time-wise. And it's also sort of the shortest of what would be considered an ultra as well. And so I think it just touched that space that made it different enough from the whole enchilada and the White Rim that it needed to be included to really get that remoteness and that true endurance piece involved in this Triple Crown.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, like you were trying to see how to touch on all the different aspects of mountain biking, and if you don't have, and maybe the game, that one really long route can just kind of ticks that box too of what is truly challenging, because for you, like you said, it's your longest ride, so it's a whole new can of worms, right? Like a whole different process of everything. Even your coaches might not know what to say.
And I wanted to do something that took me out of my comfort zone.
Right.
Because that's what I'm preaching to people is go out, try it, doing something out of your comfort zone. And so I have to practice what I preach. Mm-hmm. And I have to be brave enough to stand up and try something that I don't know if I can do it.
Right.
And so that was, for me, that was especially prevalent in this piece of entering into the unknown and saying, it's okay if I fail, because the point is to try.
Yeah. Yeah. And what kind, what's the terrain like on this one in comparison to the full enchilada?
Is
it more like hike a bike, long climbs, technical descents? Sorry, I know I interrupted you.
No, great. It's all of the above. So it starts out of the gate with a 2.5-3 hour climb, and then you start, you know, in the meat of it into some longer rollers. There is a hike a bike. There's a long flat section in the sand, and you end on super technical terrain. So it's sort of a mix of all of the above, but the overarching description I would give this course is rugged. So it's not technical in the typical sense of mountain biking. I think if you're, you know, a diehard mountain biker who loves single track, there's only 12 miles of single track in the 137 miles, but it's very chunky. And so it's very physical. So a lot of the climbs are having 4-5 inch ledges where you're lifting your front wheel up, and same thing on the descent where it's a full body experience. It's just enough that, yes, you need to be a mountain biker. Yes, you need a full suspension mountain bike. And it's going to be a full body experience.
And would you say, like, needing the full suspension mountain bike, is there a minimum, like, is 100 mils rear suspension enough, or should you be looking at 130? Yeah. Like, just to have that, just something, right, to help you?
Exactly. 100 mils is perfect. Like, there's nothing super crazy out there that you're going to encounter, but you do need that suspension, one, for speed, because the compliance is fast, but also because if you are attempting it as a single day route, it's going to beat you up. Right. Like, again, it's very rugged. It's very physical. And that was something I experienced both times I did it, is the amount that it takes out of your whole body. I think my triceps were what was most sore both times I did it, waking up the next day.
So let's talk about your first attempt. You fell short by just 16 minutes, which has got to be a punch in the gut in that sense. What did you learn from that experience? And, you know, did it take you a while to get over that and kind of figure out what your game plan would be?
Yeah. So I'm so thankful for that. I call it a failure because that's what it was, but I don't mean it in the negative connotation of the term. Failures don't have to be the end of the story. It was a learning experience. It was, so when I started the route, it was about 30 degrees. You might have to help me out if you know Fahrenheit, these conversions. Right?
So, just below zero.
Yeah. And then as I went upwards in elevation, because you climb straight out of the gate.
It was getting colder.
It was getting colder and colder. The wind started blowing and I was having 20 mile per hour winds, and the temperature dropped to 8 degrees.
Yeah, I don't even know what that is, but that's a 0 degree sleep bag is minus 18, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, so very, very cold. And I am doing it fully self-supported. So all I had was a wind jacket and some arm warmers and leg warmers. I can't receive anything else. My hands froze and all of my fluids froze. And they didn't re-thaw
until... Oh, wow, okay, yeah.
Yeah, until the sun came out and like truly started warming everything. And so I was without any fluids for 5 hours.
Okay.
I had frost nip on my fingers and I was severely dehydrated. I had hypothermia and I had a 20 mile per hour headwind through the whole flat section. And so it was just a day of being absolutely beaten down, but holding on to the hope and the belief. Because
you're at the same time, you're like, I don't want to have to come back out here. let me get through this.
It's like, I've set my mind to do this. I've come here. I've prepared. This is my chance. And all day, and people ask, you know, why did you keep going? One, because the point isn't always to win. The point is to try. And so that's what I was out there doing, is I was trying. And all day long, I was ahead of the time. I was ahead of the time, every checkpoint, every checkpoint. And with 12 hour or with 1 hour to go, I was dead locked on the time.
Okay.
And I had, all I had to do was go 1 second faster than the previous FKT holder.
So you were never out of it. That's the problem. It's like,
it was never out of it.
Way out of it halfway through, you'd be like, okay, let's maybe reevaluate.
But in that last, but in those last 12 miles, the whole day took its, I mean, I was hypothermic. Mm-hmm. I was delirious. I took a wrong turn because I was so out of it. I could barely eat. I was so dehydrated and I lost it. Mm-hmm. And I remember screaming in my head in the final miles. Like, I honestly hope I never forget that exact moment and feeling, just screaming in my head, you have to go, you have to go. Because in my head, I was still fully aware of what I was doing and what I was trying to do. But the mind-body connection was gone. And it just, I was inching along. And when I finally crossed that finish line and I lost it, I was devastated. Absolutely devastated, because it took so much.
Of you.
And I failed. Like, it's just of like me, exactly. Of exactly. I put my heart and soul into it. And my whole physical body. That's the thing, is I'm sad I didn't achieve it. And now I'm waking up the next day absolutely wrecked.
Yeah.
But it gave me, honestly, one of the biggest gifts of my career, because it is the hardest thing I have ever done. And it completely shifted my viewpoint on what hard is. And so now I have this whole new goalpost and this whole new barometer of how far I can push my body.
Yeah.
And that's something I think I'm going to have forever now. And so when I did line up again, I had this new superpower of how deep I could go. And that whole time, if I had not had that first experience, I would not have beaten the record by as much as I did in the second one, because I used that barometer the whole time. You know, believe me, even when you're not freezing cold, I'm sure you know, 10 hours into an effort, you're still not feeling great.
I might be Canadian, but I hate cold. My hands and feet do not do well in cold. Like, well, it's my Achilles heel or tendon, for sure.
So even in this second effort, when everything is seemingly going right, 10 hours in, I'm still suffering. I'm still in so much pain. But now I have this new opportunity, this new mindset where I get to say, but it's not as hard as the first time.
Yeah.
And that lets me keep going.
And on that second attempt, you also had like freezing temperatures, snow, headwinds. You filtered some of your own water, I think.
Correct. Yes.
Like, so I guess, how did you go into this one with a different mindset or strategy, you know, like knowing water's going to freeze, or how did you?
Well, I didn't. Not have freezing temperatures on the second one.
Oh, okay,
the second one. Yeah. The second one was much, much better conditions. Mm. And so we planned, we did it in a different time of year. I picked the day more carefully. Like, I filtered water because I was actually able to drink my water. Much better experience overall. But this was the one where, like I talked about at the beginning, I really went into it with, this will not be perfect.
I'd like to take a moment to thank a couple more sponsors of the Bikepack Adventures podcast. Redshift Sports was founded in 2013 by a team of mechanical engineers who also happen to be avid cyclists. From the beginning, they focused on taking a different approach to product development, drawing on their own experiences and needs to create components that make a meaningful difference to the riding experience. The highly popular shock-stop suspension system smooths out road imperfections, reducing fatigue and strain. You can check them out at redshiftsports.com or follow the affiliate link down in the show notes to help sustain the podcast. Use the promo code BPA15 to save 15% at checkout. Tailfin Cycling, designer of technical bikepacking equipment, has been creating waves in the cycling community for several years, having stepped outside the conventional boundaries of bikepacking equipment to find unique solutions that make the adventure all the better. Whether an endurance racer, bike tour, or bikepacker, these bags offer solutions for everyone. From their unique rear rack with quick release mechanism to their ingenious locking mechanism on their panniers that provide a rattle-free biking experience, Tailfin continues to push the envelope. I'm extremely pleased to have them supporting the podcast and to represent them on all my adventures.
But I fully trust myself to handle anything that comes my way. And so that's where I really learned that mindset. Because in the first one, it did feel like the whole day, it's unraveling. Like, this is not what I planned. This is not what I wanted. In the second one, it's like, and this is something as well that I feel like I've really embraced with these FKTs, is we are guests in these landscapes.
Yeah.
And when I'm out there, there's sometimes this desire to, why is the wind blowing, or why is it sandy, or why this or why that? And now I feel like I have an approach more like, this is what it is and I am the guest. So I'm not thinking, why is it this way or how can I change it? I'm thinking, this is what it is and it's my job to overcome it.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. I like that. And you did a really great job the second time around. You took a huge chunk out of the fastest known time, setting a new bar. It must have felt good.
It definitely felt good. Very rewarding, for sure.
Tears of joy that time, huh?
Yes, big time. Yeah. Sometimes success is made sweeter by failure. In fact, almost always.
Yeah, definitely. The third FKT, I mean, there was about I guess it was kind of like a year between each of these events, right? Mm-hmm. I think from the whole enchilada to the first run on the Cocopelli, second run on the Cocopelli, and now the White Rim Trail.
Exactly.
Coming in at a much easier 100 miles. I don't know how much elevation, so you could probably tell me that.
6,000 feet, I believe.
6,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about it. I know it's a like remote mountain desert, I guess you would call it. Tell us a bit more about the route and what makes it, you know, physically and mentally demanding.
Yeah. So this one is, like you said, 100-mile loop. It's primarily through the Canyonlands National Park. And so it's, you know, it's in a national park, which makes it a very special place to be. And it has, you know, it's called the White Rim for a reason. It has a lot of the really spectacular rock formations that Moab is so well known for. And so this route is a mixture of sand and a lot of embedded sort of slick rock. Okay. And so you're either sinking into the sand or bouncing on the rock. So again, this one is not technical. It's less technical even than the Cocopelli, but still very physically demanding because the terrain is challenging no matter which section you're on. It's also a challenging route because the beginning, you start by descending down into Canyonlands. Then you do the primary part of the loop all through Canyonlands, which is undulating up and down. And then you have the very end of it is climbing back up out of Canyonlands.
Brutal.
Yes. So you end with about a 1,500-foot climb at the very end of this six-hour effort. And so this one made the cut not only because of the speed of it, because the views of it, but also because over the years, this has become one of the most well sought after FKTs in the mountain bike community. And so people have been coming, trying to set and reset this FKT for years and years and years. And so I wanted to do this one as the last one to sort of prove to myself that I had what it took to compete against this FKT that has stood the test of time and that has been shaved down and optimized over the years. So I saved this one for last because I knew that the time gaps on this one would likely be the smallest, simply right. because the more something is done, the better people do it and the harder it is to beat.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a very fast route. When I look at like yes. 6.5 hours on 100 miles, I think when I road biked, you know, even going 40 kilometers an hour, that's like a 4 hour hard ride.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. and that's a road bike going really quick.
Exactly.
6.5 hours on a mountain bike, I can't imagine covering 100 miles. You did it unsupported. I know that previously there had been a supported and an unsupported FKT, mm-hmm. and you were going out there with the mindset of taking them both down all at the same time. I would ask you why, but I think I know the why. It's just a little bit of insanity mixed in with fun.
Exactly. Why not?
Why not? Well, I mean, both the previous ones were unsupported, right? And so why not just stick with that?
Exactly.
Yeah. How did your nutrition and hydration strategy look for this one compared to the others?
Yeah, I think, you know, so this one, again, it's fast enough, it's short enough, and it's remote enough that there was no stopping for filtering, in my opinion, on this right. one. There is maybe a place or two that you could do that if you wanted to. I didn't feel like there was time for that. Mm-hmm. And I felt like air was short enough that I could get away with not doing it. But also, speeds are so high that I wanted to keep weight down. I wanted to stay also as aero as possible, so not having a ton of stuff on me or my bike was important. And so I took a really minimalist approach to this one. I kept the carbohydrates high with the liquid shot gels that I use, which I used on the Coco Pelly as well. But then for water, I worked with my dietitian to essentially figure out what's the least amount of fluids that I can safely do this on. And so for for me, was 3 liters over this 6.5 hour effort. Okay. So that's pretty minimal, unless you're a professional athlete attempting to do this with the guidance of other professionals. I do not recommend that. Most people are going to take, you know, 7-8 liters on something like this and take longer. But that was another reason we started just at first light, so that one, I wouldn't have to carry lights on my bike, but so that I had that coolest hours of the day. And I definitely cut it
less dehydration, very
exactly. And I still cut it very close. When I entered the final climb, I basically had 2 sips of water left, one for the bottom and one for the top.
So, I hate that feeling, basically, you know, the like last when you're climb. Just like savoring. Oh, and with my Bibble bottle, usually it. There's a little bit, there's like one mouthful at the bottom, and I'm like waiting. When is the time where I'm going to open it and just suck down those last few drops, knowing exactly. there's nothing else?
I know, it's so painful. And then if you really get desperate and you're just trying to get that last little bit of moisture that's down there, even when mm-hmm. you know nothing's left, that's when you know you're really running on empty.
Yeah. You've previously said that FKTs are like the perfect puzzle. What pieces mm-hmm. had to come together to make this one work for you?
Yeah, I think, a lot of pieces. I think, you know, for me, the fitness, right? Like I have to physically be strong enough to do it. The pacing, especially on the White Rim, you know, for any power nerds out there, my average power and my normalized power were within about 10 watts of each other. So this is an opportunity where you are on the pedals all day. Mm. And so it is an opportunity to try and really pace perfectly from point A to point B. And with the long climb being at the end, you're really rewarded if you can get that pacing strategy correctly. And then the nutrition, you know, I was really threading the needle, like right. I said, on that. And then finally, the things that I tried my best to anticipate, but are ultimately completely out of my control. So one of those is the wind. Since this is a loop, eventually you will have a headwind or a tailwind, but how strong, that was the biggest thing that we were desperately trying to anticipate. We moved the date of the attempt back and forth a couple times, trying to guess which day would be the quietest on the wind. And then finally, the terrain. Like I said, about half of this effort is done in very sandy conditions. And that's actually the one piece of the puzzle that didn't quite come together for us. And that's where then that attitude of resilience over perfection came in, because it was extremely sandy. I was told in the week before from numerous people that it was, quote, the sandiest they had ever seen.
Oh, no way. Okay.
And it honestly, it was very overwhelming to hear that in the week leading up. Definitely feeling flashbacks of the first attempt of the Kogopelli of, oh my gosh, I'm putting myself in a position to fail. Why, you know, why would this happen? But ultimately just deciding again, the attitude, well, I have to try.
Did you?
And No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, did you, knowing that this was so sandy this year and stuff, did that lead to a change in tires that would maybe grip a little bit better, or ride, or a little bit bigger tires that would ride a little bit better? Or was it just a, this is what we're ready for and we're going for it?
It was just, this is what we're ready for and we're going for it. You know, and for me, that ultimately came down to mindset. I think that's one of those things where when something's uncontrollable, you can choose to fixate on it, or you can choose to focus on the things you can control. And once I heard that it was sandy, I, you know, we talked about it, we prepped the best we could, and then I told everyone, I don't want to hear about it anymore, because nothing's changing. There's no point in dwelling. And when I went out there for the attempt and I finished, my whole crew was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you got the time. It was so sandy. I can't believe you did it. And I was like, guys, I really feel like you guys really blew it out of proportion. Like, it wasn't that sandy. And then the next day,
in your mind, you were expecting worse yet, right?
Well, in my mind, I think I just completely blocked it out. Because then the next day we went back out. We were getting a couple extra photos, a couple extra shots. So we went back out on the trail, and you know, they were having me ride these little sections to get the shot. And I could I could barely ride them. Like, I was unclipping and stopping. Like, it's like, guys, how did it get so sandy overnight? This is wild. Like, we got so lucky. And they're like, no, Hannah, this is exactly how it was yesterday. You just chose to ignore it.
Zombie.
And I think, yeah. And I think that really shows the power of the mind.
Yeah.
We hold total power over what we choose to focus on. And I think that's so important in all aspects of our life, whether it's on the bikes or just in our day-to-day life.
And I know the night before the event, you said, I wish it was easier. And your partner replied, no, you don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Where did that come from? And like, what's, can you unpack that moment a bit?
Yeah, these attempts are hard. They're really hard. And they're also very vulnerable. You know, I think anyone who's tried something this hard knows that there's a vulnerability that comes with that. And that's also why a lot of friendships come out of racing, come out of doing hard things, because when you are that vulnerable, you're open to other people and you meet people where they're at, which is beautiful. But there is a vulnerability and it's scary. And our reaction as human beings, no matter if we've raced for 20 years like I have or never raced before, is when something's scary, our brain tries to protect us. It tries to find a way out. It tries to make it easier. It tries to tell you it's okay, you don't have to do it. And what you learn over time is how to respond to that, but it still comes every time. And so that was a moment when I was sitting on the bed in our Airbnb, and I was thinking about how hard it's going to be. I was thinking about the fear of failing. I was thinking about, well, what if this happens and what if that happens? And I was going down that very natural, vulnerable rabbit hole and thinking, man, I just wish it was easier, because I was scared.
Yeah.
But what Clayton said was so simple but so profound of saying, no, you don't. Because even though my brain is looking for an out, is looking to tell me it's, you know, you don't have to do this. That's why I do it. Do it because it's hard. If it was easy, I wouldn't have even been there. I wouldn't have put it on the list because it's the hard things in life that are worth doing and that change us as people.
Yeah. I created a bikepacking route in this region. And, you know, my goal was to put as much single track and mountain bike stuff as I could into it.
I love it.
And so it goes into a ski hill. And instead of like cutting through the ski hill, like we go up the climbing hill and then nice. Come down all the, you know, and I gave a buy from the double black diamond hairpin turn section that you could take the fire road for the last part. But, you know, I love it. And I've had people say like, this is a really difficult route. Like it's, mm-hmm. it just beats you nonstop. And then when you're not on single track, you're like rugged backcountry gravel roads. And it's just fun in a bad way.
Exactly.
But it's a fun later kind of way, you know, like not at the time, but.
It's the kind of fun that changes you. And yeah. I think that's something that, you know, I'm reminded of all the time in this career that I have is at the end of the day, it's not going to be about the wins. It's not mm-hmm. going to be about the trophies. It's not going to be about the FKTs. It's going to be about the person that I became along the way. And I think that person has only developed through doing hard things. And also, as challenging as it is, failing sometimes
yeah.
at those hard things and trying again anyways.
Amazing. And was there a point on that third route, the White Rim Trail, where you're like, I am on pace and just don't stop going, you know, like just keep giving her?
Yeah, you know, this one I was able to break down a little bit better because mm-hmm. I had more data on the previous FKT. And so I was able to really look at how the time splits laid out. And I knew that the previous FKT holder had gone quite fast at the beginning and slowed down towards the end.
Okay.
So I was pretty mentally prepared to be behind in the start. But about an hour and a half in, I was 2 minutes up. And so that was a very motivating surprise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then at about the halfway mark, I had 8 minutes.
Oh,
And so, again, very motivating. But through my experience on the Kogopelli, losing it all in the final 12 miles that first time, I felt like I was holding my breath. You know, it was like, okay, just don't mess up. Just hold it here. And so at that point, I really did lock in to a pace. And saved it for that final climb because I knew if I could execute on that final climb, that was ultimately
yeah. And what you don't want to blow up on the climb either.
Exactly. Like, okay. That's why you have to be a little careful on the back end of that effort.
Was there anything specific about this route that, like, that you learned that maybe the other ones didn't teach you?
Yeah, this one for me, the biggest learning opportunity was on focus. Because their speed was so high and the margins were so small, I knew that I needed to focus on every turn, every pedal stroke, every line choice. And locking in that style of focus for 6.5 hours is quite a challenge. And I worked a lot with a sports psychologist for it. And we talked about different ways to focus. And, you know, I originally was going to have music for the effort because I'm all alone. It's unsupported. No one is even allowed to speak to me. But ultimately, you know, because I asked the sports psychologist, okay, I think I'm going to use music. Wouldn't it be a good distraction from the pain so then I can push harder? And her response was, well, we aren't trying to distract from the pain. We're trying to feel the pain and go anyways. And I loved that because it's absolutely true. You know, I was feeling pain, some level of pain, as early as 30 minutes into this.
Right.
And by listening to that rather than distracting from it, I was able to balance on that line so much better.
Yeah. And I think when you're feeling the pain, you slowly get accustomed to it and it kind of numb to it. So then you can like go another step and see what kind of pain that brings.
Exactly. You befriend the pain.
It was a very fortunate, it's very cool that you were able to document this journey in the film Chasing the Triple Crown. What inspired you to share it visually? And was it mostly focused on the White Rim as opposed to all three? Or was it kind of something that carried on multiple years?
Yeah, so we got to do a film of each of them. So there's a film for the whole enchilada, a film for the Cogopelli, and then this Chasing the Triple Crown primarily documents the White Rim,
okay. But
certainly documents the entire journey to get there and why we end up there, which is chasing this Triple Crown.
Yeah.
And for me, it's really important to document these things, not as, some sort of claim to fame, but to show people, I don't even know how to finish that sentence, to show people what's possible, to show people what's out there, all of the above, because, and this is something that I had to decide early on with these attempts is some people, maybe you're probably familiar since you're from the bike hacking world, will say if you have a film crew, it doesn't count. Or it doesn't count as supported. and that's okay. For me, that's why we make the rule that they can't speak to me.
Right. I like that. I like that kind of compromise.
Yeah, they can't speak to me so that there's absolutely no motivation there. They can't travel on most of this terrain at the speed I can. So most of the time, I'm not seeing them for 3+ hours anyway as they leapfrog me. They certainly, the other comment I get is, well, they could evac you, though. They can't evac me because they're on a motorcycle. They can't take me out. There's no way, I am traveling with an SOS device of my own that if something happened, it would be on me to use that. But regardless, I recognize that is a valid thing that people say. And if they don't want to count it, that's totally fine. And I still made the decision to document it, because for me, the point is to inspire people. I want people to see me go through the pain and come out the other side and know that they can too. And I want people to see what's out there and hopefully give them a desire to see it as well.
Yeah.
And I want people who can't see it to see what's out there. I know there's a lot. I'm so thankful for a body that can take me out on these routes and show me these places. And I know that there are people who don't have those capabilities for whatever reason. And I still want them to be able to live vicariously through some of these films.
Yeah. I don't think it counts now. No, I'm sorry. It's such a contentious thing. But I think, what it is, it's whoever's the race director kind of gets to decide how they view that aspect.
Totally. Yeah.
And my only thing that I don't really like is when it gets flip-flopped around, they had some issues with the tour divide with that, where it was allowed some years and then not, and then,
well, then which record's which, really exactly.
It, whatever you had decided originally, stick to your guns and don't let the keyboard warriors, play on that. Just decide, Yeah, you said you were excited to see other people take on this Triple Crown. What kind of rider do you think this challenge is built for?
Every rider, in my opinion. I mean, it's hard. You have to have some level of experience. In terms of taking the Triple Crown, in terms of holding the records, I think the most resilient rider will win. But in terms of just doing it, which is what I'm trying to motivate people to achieve, is anyone with a sense of adventure and a willingness to try, because that's all it takes. It doesn't matter how fast or how slow you go. I want anyone to go out there and try, because I think you'll come out the other side more in love with your bike, more in love with the world that you live in, and as a new person.
Yeah. And as you were mentioning earlier about the videos, I think I've meant to say also, it's like some people just, they might not be in America, or you might have the wrong nationality or passport or anything to come to the U.S. So it's like they get to live vicariously through those experiences of other people and see new things, you know. So there is real good benefit on that.
Absolutely.
Do you see FKTs becoming a bigger part of mountain biking's future? You know, I know it's not as common as when you look at like bikepacking routes, you know, like long distance bikepacking routes or those kind of things, or hiking, I guess, as well. Backpacking, what do you call it? Through hiking. What are your thoughts and views on where mountain biking?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would love to see them become more of a thing. I think that they have over the last 5 years or so. You know, we definitely had a big uptick in FKT attempts in 2020 when races were shut down. Mm-hmm. And we've, you know, that's really when the right rim started to take off. And we've seen a lot of people go and take on that challenge since then. And so my hope is that the more, I think people will always follow competition. So I think the higher the bar is raised, the more people will come to keep doing it. And that's another thing that I hope to have done is raise the bar to a point that it's very intriguing that other athletes and other professionals want to test their mettle and see what they can put, what kind of time they can put on the board.
Yeah. And I look at, you know, things like FKT rides and long distance, especially long distance bikepacking, very, you know, gender is an equalized, becomes much more equalized, you know, where women are able to compete with some of the men in terms of speed and stuff. It's no longer as divisive as maybe some shorter rides. How has mountain bike felt like that for you? And how do you hope to get more women into mountain biking? Because I think it's still very niche in that aspect.
It definitely is. You know, I think at the distances that I'm doing, you know, we still definitely see men putting faster times on the board, at least, you know, for now. And so, yeah, I mean, that is what it is. But for me as a woman, my hope is to show other women what's possible. You know, there's a lot of races that I do that there's thousands of people, but less than 5% are females lining up. And that's not going to change unless we keep doing it. And I think as we continue to line up, we show other women that it is possible, that they can do it. And whether it's a physical thing or a breaking down barriers and opportunities thing, to me, that's neither here nor there. I still want women to see that it is possible to make the time and the space and the training commitment and all of those things to be out here and to do it. And ultimately, for women in this space, I want them to feel how powerful they are because there's a lot of places in a woman's life that they are made to feel smaller, but out there in the middle of the desert, going as fast as I can on my bike, that is not one of them. That's a place I feel big. I feel owning my own space. I feel like anything is possible. And that's a feeling that I hope every woman can have.
Yeah. I live just north of Ottawa in this little town called Chelsea, and it's a very much it's right on the edge of a big mountain bike, like big Gatineau Park, which is all lots full of trails. And there's so many times where I'm coming home from work and, you know, come rip out of the trail comes like, you know, half a dozen girls who are probably
amazing.
In upper elementary, middle school, high school, what kind of thing, 14, 15 maybe. And I look at it and I'm just like, man, I hope Jasmine is one of those one day. That's my daughter. You know, she's a little princess in the sense that she wants to sleep in dresses and she wears dresses all the time and loves having her nails on.
I was
on,
that
nails
way too
all
as
done
little
and
kid.
Jewelry.
Yes.
But she loves being on the bike. And I'm like, you know what? A princess can ride bikes and they can do pretty well too.
Absolutely. I love that so much. I absolutely, as a little kid, I was always wearing dresses, all that kind of stuff. But like you said, princesses can ride bikes too. They're pretty tough.
Yeah. Let's talk about a bit of you know, reflection and future stuff. But having completed this Triple Crown, how has there been a change in your relationship with the bike, and how has that impacted you?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything that we've talked about. I think it's allowed me to let go of perfection and instead pursue progress. It's allowed me to redefine what hard is, and that applies to both on and off the bike. After the Coco Pelli, that film is called Coco Pelli Strong. And after that film, my husband, that's how that film got its name, is after that first attempt, my husband and I started saying the phrase, with anything in on the bike or in life, when things were hard, it's okay, it's time to be Coco Pelli strong. Yeah, exactly. And so that's certainly something I've taken from these. I mean, I think just a feeling also of competence, like we're talking about, for women, but for anyone, of, man, if I can do that, then I, you know, I think as people, we constantly compare. It's a way that our brain is able to dictate what we can do, to dictate what's safe, to dictate what's possible. And when you do something really hard, your brain does take it as a benchmark of,
right,
oh, well, if I can do that, then I can do this. If I can do this, then I can do that. And I feel like these FKTs have moved that for me. And it's allowed me to feel more proficient in multiple areas of my life.
Nice. And what is next for you? Another FKT, some racing, anything completely different?
All of the above. Yeah, I'm finishing up the race season now. So I just got back from the mountain bike marathon. Yes, I just got back from the mountain bike marathon world championship in Switzerland. And now I've got a couple weeks at home before I've got the final two races of the season. And then we do have another FKT on tap as well.
Is it a secret or?
I can't share it just yet, but we'll leave that we have another one out there.
Nice. Do you look at some of the longer ones like the Arizona Trail race, Colorado Trail, or no comment?
Oh, no, I do. I mean, I'll say that these are things that I'm like secretly looking at and planning in the background. But you know,
it's hard to blend with your racing calendar.
It's hard to blend with the racing calendar, but I think it's also important for me to acknowledge and humble myself and say, I have learning to do before I go for those. And I am learning slowly. So it's something I hope to tackle one day. But yeah, major props to all the people and especially women out there tackling those, because those are a lot more, in my limited knowledge, a lot more than just riding your bike. There's a lot of elements that you have to be very good at to achieve those.
And I think we're seeing this thing where, you know, like pro road racers are retiring from road and then like diving into gravel and setting, you know, amazingly high bars and stuff, and it's gonna grow that sport, which will then grow, you know, it has a follow-on effect.
Absolutely.
And I think like seeing people like you going from, you know, mountain bike racing to FKTing some routes and then going to bigger stuff, it also sets that bar, and people will you know, keep pushing themselves.
I hope so.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your journey. Where can listeners follow you or watch Chasing the Triple Crown?
Yeah, so for watching all of these videos, including Chasing the Triple Crown, you can find them on the Competitive Cyclist YouTube channel. And then you can follow me on Instagram at the Hannah Otto.
At the Hannah Otto. Cool. Anything I missed that you wanted to chat about before we hang this up?
I think we covered it. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right.
Awesome.
Talk soon. Well, that's a wrap of this episode of the Bikepack Adventures podcast. Huge thanks to Hannah Otto for sharing not just her record-breaking ride, but the philosophy and fire behind it. If you're inspired by her journey, check out her film Chasing the Triple Crown. The links will be in the show notes. It's a powerful look at what happens when you stop chasing titles and start chasing transformation. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with someone who needs a reminder that the hardest roads often lead to the most meaningful destinations. Until next time, keep on pedaling, and remember, adventure isn't just out there, it's in you.
I want to end the show by thanking all my listeners once again for the emails and comments I regularly receive from you. It really helps motivate me and keep me going with this project and to continue sharing people's amazing stories. If you have any comments or questions, you can email me at chris@bikepackadventures.ca or go to bikepackadventures.ca and shoot me a message through the contact form. You can also check out the webpage for past podcast episodes, bikepacking routes throughout Canada, blog posts, videos, and touring tips. Lastly, I'd like to once again thank all the individuals and companies that are supporting the podcast. Head over to bikepackadventures.ca/partners for some amazing deals. If you're enjoying the show and would like to become a supporting member, head over to www.patreon.com/bikepackadventures to sign up. Patreons get to enjoy early access and ad-free podcast episodes. You can also support the show by sending a one-time donation through PayPal. This money all goes back into the podcast, helping me to cover the costs associated with running the show, buy new equipment when necessary, and continue to produce the high-quality content that you've become accustomed to. Much appreciated, and keep on pedaling.